This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we are grappling with yet another mass shooting in this country. Dozens dead in Las Vegas and hundreds more wounded in what is now being called the largest mass shooting in recent American history. We keep looking at these events unfold in a collective state of shock, but still, the epidemic of gun violence marches on.
Well, our hearts go out to everybody affected by this tragedy. And Mark, it is an epidemic. 33,000 Americans died at the end of a gun barrel in 2014 alone. More than 300 million guns in circulation in this country. And the data are clear. The more guns you have in circulation, the greater likelihood of gun violence. We want to give a shout out to the incredible trauma response teams at the hospitals and the paramedics. They have prepared and planned for such tragedies, but you can never really be prepared for something of this magnitude. And they just did a remarkable job. So our hats off and our hearts go out to all of them.
Absolutely.
And we think back to our own personal experience after the Sandy Hook shootings here in Connecticut. Hundreds and hundreds of healthcare providers, especially behavioral health providers, were required to help those families and community members grapple with the aftermath of that tragedy. We know the magnitude of what lies ahead for the survivors of this latest attack. The people that were affected by Sandy Hook continue to suffer.
This much is true. Gun violence is a public health crisis in the United States, and we need to start addressing it as such. Watching this terrible event unfold in Las Vegas is just another harsh reminder of how much tragedy is set into motion every day from the prevalence of gun violence in our culture. We've had a dearth of good research data on gun violence in this country. We need to support more research in that area of gun violence.
The quest for good data overall leads us to our guest today, Mark. Dr. John Brownstein is the Chief Innovation Officer at Boston Children's Hospital. He's developed a health monitoring system called computational epidemiology, which allows for real-time tracking of disease monitoring. And his disease tracking methods have helped everybody from Homeland Security to the CDC to the World Health Organization.
It's also led to collaborations with tech giants like Google, Apple, and ride-hailing startup Uber. He's a very interesting innovator in the health data space. Looking forward to that conversation, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. John Brownstein in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Americans are calling for a discussion on gun violence in the wake of the latest deadly mass shooting on American soil. Hundreds of concertgoers in Las Vegas were shot by a lone gunman, killing dozens and wounding hundreds more. There is mounting pressure for Congress to start acknowledging gun violence as a public health crisis in this country. 33,000 deaths by gun alone in 2014. A recent study showed gun violence accounts for about $230 billion in health and medical costs, as well as lost economic revenue. There have been more than 1,500 mass shootings since the Sandy Hook massacre in 2012. Last week, Congress passed a bill that scaled back background checks for gun purchases in some cases. In an in-depth recent study, data showed that gun deaths were much higher in states with higher gun ownership, as well as more lax gun laws. Law enforcement officials were also more likely to be shot in those states as well. In the wake of the Las Vegas massacre, Congress did shelve a bill indefinitely that would have made it easier for gun owners to purchase silencers. Former U.S. Representative Gabby Giffords and her husband demanded that Congress take up the issue of gun safety and gun purchasing laws. Giffords was the victim herself of a mass shooting while making a campaign appearance. Meanwhile, the White House made a stop in Puerto Rico 2 weeks after Hurricane Maria devastated the entire island. A majority of that American territory still without power or potable water or cell service, medicines, and food. Relief agencies predict it could be months or possibly even years before the island will be able to fully recover from that disaster. Congress failed to meet a September 30th deadline to continue authorization of the CHIP program. That's the Children's Health Insurance Program, helping meet the health care needs of some 9 million children across the country. States like Minnesota are out of CHIP funding and have required federal assistance to continue handling the program. Utah has warned it will cancel the CHIP program at the end of the year if Congress fails to act, imperiling health care for about 20,000 kids in that state. CHIP covers the most kids in California, about 1.3 million children. Congress appears ready to tackle the reauthorization in the near future. And price out, who's in? HHS Secretary Tom Price resigned from his post following revelations that he spent over $1 million of taxpayer money jetting around to personal and professional business on private planes. Some names being considered to replace him: Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan and TV's Dr. Mehmet Oz. But the odds-on favorite at the moment is CMS Administrator Seema Verma, a health consultant and confidant of Vice President Pence. VA Secretary David Shulkin is also a leading contender. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Brownstein, Chief Innovation Officer and Director of Computational Epidemiology Group at Boston Children's Hospital. He's Professor of Pediatric Epidemiology at Harvard Medical School, where he also has a research focus on consumer technologies that drive health. He's also developed several disease surveillance systems, including HealthMap.org, an internet-based global infectious disease intelligence system. He has advised Google on disease tracking systems and also has helped the ride-sharing company Uber create its health division. Dr. Brownstein has advised the White House, Homeland Security, and the World Health Organization on managing real-time public health surveillance data. Dr. Brownstein is Vice President of the International Society for Disease Surveillance. He's earned his PhD in epidemiology at Yale. Dr. Brownstein, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. You know, in your expertise in this area of health data surveillance, sometimes called computational epidemiology or e-epidemiology, has earned you the title of the go-to guy when it comes to tech-based entities seeking to enter the health sector. And I'm wondering if you could frame up for our listeners what computational epidemiology is all about and why it has attracted the attention of so many tech-based organizations.
I mean, truly, epidemiology is all about the study of disease in person, place, time, and it's always leveraged, you know, data sets to understand disease, understand risk factors of disease. And generally, we've dealt in probably in smaller types of data sets collected by surveys, field collection. And as new technologies have emerged, the ability to harness much larger data sets has come into view. So whether that's data that comes from clinical care and electronic medical records, data that comes from our day-to-day activities and our interactions with technology, there's a lot more data about an individual. And as those larger data sets become available, new methods need to be applied, new computational tools need to be brought into play to interpret that data. Of course, you know, as new tech has emerged and, you know, companies like Google and Twitter and Facebook have emerged, and yes, they're great data sets for learning about your preferences and data sets that can be applied towards marketing products towards you. But at the same time, they can actually be incredibly valuable for understanding your individual health and understanding your health behaviors. And this is where I think there's some great opportunities in population health, in health services research, to really understand new risk factors of disease and really influence care as well.
Well, Dr. Brownstein, I understand that your early interest in epidemiology took root during your academic days at Yale when you were tracking the growing incidence and threat of Lyme disease, which is concentrated in particularly high numbers here in the Northeast, but spreading across the country, certainly. Yeah. And you also were focused on the West Nile virus in those earlier days, seeking to identify and chart the progress in the course of these pathogens. Can you talk with us a little bit about that earlier work and what you learned from those disease tracking efforts, how it informs the work that you're doing today with so many new technologies to work with?
So, you know, some of the early work that I was involved in was really much more field-based, to be honest. So my work on Lyme disease was all about collecting ticks in the field and understanding how landscape and climate are influencing the distribution of Lyme disease. And similarly for West Nile virus, how changes in climate and environment are important for disease transmission. It was challenging, you know, collecting that data in the field, the expense of it. And in fact, I actually got Lyme disease collecting ticks in the field, recognized I was probably not the best field surveillance person out there in the world. And so clearly it was like, okay, well, maybe there's another way for me to access important data and be able to do models at much larger scales. And this is what sort of brought me here to Boston, where there was great opportunities to tap into, say, for instance, clinical record systems, which people at that time really weren't thinking about to get insights about disease populations. People weren't thinking about aggregating all that data up at that time. Now it's a lot more commonplace. Right. But at the same time, that clinical data is heavily siloed. You're not seeing it, you know, it's not connected across large scales. So I, you know, thought to myself, well, what other data sets are out there that we can start to tap into? I started realizing, well, there's all this data on the web. You can do a Google search and someone's talked about a disease in a population. There's blogs, there's chat rooms, you know, there's the emergence of social media. All this data, these sort of digital breadcrumbs that, you know, people leave behind can be incredibly valuable, but just nobody was aggregating that information. But it was much easier to get access to than any other data set. So that's what started leading us to thinking, okay, well, if we start developing machine learning tools and sort of big data processing to collect all this information, now we can also all of a sudden get insights in real time at massive scale in ways that had never been done before.
Well, let's look at one of the disease surveillance systems you created. HealthMap is a freely accessible automated electronic information system for monitoring global pandemics and other disease outbreaks. And you've designed it to be both an early warning system as well as the real-time health data monitoring system to better observe emerging threats to global public health. And I wonder if you could just share with us about the genesis of HealthMap and its open source approach, and maybe give us an overview, if you will.
Really, it's all about trying to figure out new ways to identify diseases and populations as early as possible to be able to mitigate the disease risk. And if we really want the public to be really a key stakeholder and really engage in whatever public health intervention, not necessarily panic, but really be informed and do things that make the most sense from disease prevention, it's all about keeping as many people in the loop as early as possible. And so HealthMap really was generated from this idea, essentially like a weather map for disease and doing that in real time. Just like you can look on your phone and see a weather forecast, you should be able to see a disease forecast. Like stay home from school if they're sick or from work or get a vaccine. At the same time, public health agencies could do a much better job of staying informed. And we've been doing this for now over 10 years where we're organizing all the world's data. So the emergence of swine flu as an example, H1N1, the first signs of it didn't come out of government reporting. It actually came out of a news article in Mexico talking about a mysterious illness. For instance, Zika, where we could track across South and Central America the emergence of it, and this was done through aggregation of all these sources, similarly with Ebola. So many great examples where the organization of major data sets can provide a view of the world that couldn't be done with any single data set alone.
Well, Dr. Brownstein, often technologies launch with a lot of anticipation for disrupting the healthcare space, but are maybe a little bit ahead of their time. But you were instrumental in helping Google launch its Flu Trends project, which I think was later shut down. Maybe there were some inconsistent results. What did you learn from that ground floor experience with Google, and how might you approach things differently since you referenced Zika and the hurricanes, plural, are so much on our mind? We all wonder, you know, what will we see and how do we track what might be happening there?
So the Google Flu Trends concept and the idea that you can mine what people search for online as an indicator of disease, it was incredibly novel, but it's also very early days in terms of using these data. It might work in one flu season, but it might not work in a following flu season because people change what they search for. And so the models have evolved pretty significantly, and there's great work that's happening across, you know, the academic realm. And in fact, our team here at Children's has actually taken over Google Flu Trends and is now called HealthMap Flu Trends with revised methods. You know, Google data is great, but when you start to match it with data from Twitter, from data from electronic medical records, with, you know, laboratory data from the CDC, that's when you get a much more robust picture. And that's really, you know, it's a good lesson. And I think, you know, when we talk about the hurricanes, looking for post-hurricane illness, you know, whether it's, you know, foodborne, you know, related or vector-borne related, these kind of data sets where people are searching you know, can be the earliest sign when public health infrastructure is not, you know, at its most robust.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Brownstein, Chief Innovation Officer and Director of the Computational Epidemiology Group at Boston Children's Hospital. He's a professor of pediatric epidemiology at Harvard Medical School, where he has a research focus on consumer technologies that drive health. He's also leading the development of several disease surveillance systems, including healthmap.org, as advisor to the ride-sharing startup Uber. And really like to sort of explore the collaboration that you've developed with Uber. And after using the service yourself, we know that millions of Americans are no-show to medical appointments, often simply because they don't have an easy way to get there. And I understand you initially reached out to Uber to offer your services in a pretty interesting way. And I wonder if you could talk about how that collaboration came about and start from the beginning and tell us the story.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much. So, as we've mentioned through this discussion, very interested in sort of emerging technologies and how they can play a role in understanding the health populations, but also how they can improve access. We also run another actually project that actually started at Google as well called Vaccine Finder, which we took over after swine flu, that essentially is a repository for all the locations where an individual can get a flu shot or other vaccines across the country. And despite it being, you know, you can't walk a block without seeing a pharmacy that's offering a flu shot,
right.
It's so challenging to get someone to go and do it, even if it's completely free. And so we had this idea of, well, if it's impossible to get someone to walk a block for a vaccine, what if the vaccine, like, showed up your doorstep? And, like, what if it was that easy? Would someone refuse it at that point? And so we saw the emergence of the huge logistics network that Uber has as a vehicle for healthcare delivery. But they obviously weren't considering that at the time. They were doing things, you know, other events like Uber ice cream or Uber kittens, other types of things. And we were like, okay, well, maybe we can convince them to do Uber Health. And so we actually emailed a support ticket because we couldn't find anybody on LinkedIn that would respond to our email. So we actually responded to a receipt that you would use to complain about the ride. Uh-huh. Instead of complaining about the ride, we actually said, well, What if you considered, you know, the ride was great, but maybe you should think about healthcare. And somehow on the other end, someone who actually has turned out to be a very close colleague saw the email and thought, wow, it was a great idea. And we worked together to build up this concept of Uber Health. And we did this event where we administered a vaccine. So we had a new button on the Uber app called Uber Health. You could get a flu shot for yourself and up to 10 people at your door. And we've done that for several years now. We've done it across 40 cities.
I think there are 1,000 entrepreneurs out there who are just about
taking
notes and about to file complaints.
I mean, it's all about the hustle, right?
And
right.
Yeah.
If you have a vision for something, I mean, it doesn't always work, but you can just find the way in. Doesn't have to be the conventional, like, my family member knows somebody at this, you know, it's just about trying to find the right angle. Mm-hmm. And a little luck, of course. So, and then, of course, that's evolved now into, you know, we actually ended up spinning out a company out of Boston Children's called Circulation, which took the concept that on-demand can be transformational in healthcare, and now actually we're using a platform that incorporates Uber and other transportation options to basically help bring patients to their appointments, help patients get home, and bring on-demand to healthcare. And so we've now expanded across over 60 healthcare systems in 30 states and really now changing the ways that people can get to their appointments. These are patients on Medicaid that have a transportation benefit that experience the most difficulty of getting to their appointment.
Well, Dr. Brownstein, you clearly have an insatiable curiosity and appetite for making things better. And I'd like to talk with you really about your role at the Center of Pediatric Epidemiology. You know, wherever we look, we see challenges to the health of children. Certainly in the United States, we've seen an uptick in the incidence of preventable childhood diseases. We look around the world globally. We see outbreaks of cholera in Yemen and Haiti, dengue fever in South and Central America. Can you talk about advances in epidemiology that are particularly exciting to you that you think might help us really grapple with these threats that impact children? You also are challenged with the epidemiology, not just of infectious illness, but of the chronic illnesses, diabetes and asthma that affect children. So talk with us about that.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting factors is, you know, we have incredible assets already in the form of vaccines. Vaccines are, you know, the cornerstone of public health. They're one of the sort of major modern discoveries, and yet we still have major challenges in getting uptake. And so oftentimes it's not as much about identifying the intervention as education and trying to deal with some of the rumors that emerge around vaccines. You know, we've built some products, you know, funded by Gates around trying to understand rumors, how they evolve, how they spread. That's part of the challenge, right? Because there's oftentimes some of these diseases are, many of them, if not, you know, the major ones are vaccine preventable. There is also the challenge of logistics and getting those vaccines in the hands of the right people at the right time. But there's also just an uptake and an adherence and an educational issue. So, you know, that's part of what, you know, we're challenged with. I mean, of course, there's a public health infrastructure around the world that is not uniform, and there's challenges many parts, many blind spots around the world where people are not looking. Obviously, there's technological tools and things that are emerging, but I think from the infectious disease realm, it's even less about technology. It's more about education. And similarly, on the chronic disease side, at Boston Children's, we're thinking about all sorts of technologies that can impact the patient journey to improve their lives and to think about, for instance, patients that are on diagnostic odysseys, how to shorten the time from them having an undiagnosed disease to them having a diagnosis and then a treatment. For us to be able to spread some of our knowledge around pediatrics much more globally, we have a technology called Open Pediatrics that's trying to train pediatric specialists around the world with best-in-class knowledge coming from here, from Boston Children. You know, we're trying to think about new ways to augment physicians with, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning. So you can start to build that into technologies to then provide that sort of know-how to a broader set of people. You know, of course, doing more with the data that we have and then collecting more data through technologies like wearables. And, you know, so when you think about chronic disease and diabetes, thinking about wearables like, you know, continuous glucose monitors that can provide data in real time towards clinical decision support. Well, there are many other ways in which we're doing a better job interacting with patients in a more continuous way.
Well, let's take a look at what appeared to be a dramatic uptake in health applications. Last year, we had Apple COO Jeff Williams on talking to us about Apple Research Kit and their hopes to dramatically expand population health research. You're one of the first developers to create an application for Apple's Care Kit. You also are seeking innovation ways to better understand Amazon's Alexa and its voice recognition technology. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of these projects. Also in the backdrop, though, is we really haven't really solved the problem of connecting electronic health records together. And so you've got, on one hand, sort of all the excitement that's going on in individual health apps, but the fundamentals still aren't of exchanging data across many platforms. So maybe you could pair those together.
The challenge of data silos is a real one, and it's a real one that patients experience in being able to transfer their health information from institution to institution in terms of aggregating multiple views on a patient into one sort of view on their health. You know, that's part of root cause of a lot of issues. We have different types of EMR platforms that don't talk to each other. We are spending a lot of time trying to integrate these data sets together through new data standards. And some of the work actually that has been done at Boston Children's, actually led by someone like Ken Mandel, is really focused on this concept of the app for the electronic medical record, which are essentially substitutable and can work on top of multiple EMRs that allow for sort of better data fluidity. You know, we're thinking about, of course, how to improve the physician experience in terms of their workflows, how to do a better job of providing as much data to them, and to also provide a better sort of more continuous interaction between a patient and a physician. But we're also looking at new technologies to do that. So voice is this one area that we've really been excited about. Our team developed the first healthcare skill for Amazon Alexa called KidsMD, which is really a consumer skill that allows parents to ask about common conditions that kids face and enables parents to get more education through just pure voice. But then voice could be an incredible tool in healthcare, whether it's a data that one can interact with in terms of, okay, so for instance, a physician wants to get access to a protocol or dosing instructions, or wants to pull up a radiology image in a hands-free environment, or wants to have dictation while they're talking to a patient. There's so many different examples where a voice assistant can be an incredible augmentation to a physician. And I think there's big opportunities to sort of really transform the physician experience and thereby the patient experience as well.
We've been speaking today with Dr. John Brownstein, Chief Innovation Officer and Director of the Computational Epidemiology Group at Boston Children's Hospital. He's also Professor of Pediatric Epidemiology at Harvard Medical School and advisor to Uber Health. You can learn more about his work by going to childrenshospital.org/researchers/John-Brownstein, or you can follow him on Twitter at John Brownstein. John, thank you so much for your innovative work and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We recently published our final report on Obama's numbers, a look at statistical indicators of now former President Obama's 8 years in office. Nearly all of the final stats are now in. On health insurance, millions of Americans gained coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The percentage of all U.S. residents who lack coverage dropped sharply from 14.7% the year before Obama entered the White House to 9% in his final year, the lowest on record. Nevertheless, those gains fell far short of Obama's 2007 campaign promise to, quote, cover every American. These numbers come from the National Health Interview Survey conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. According to NHIS figures, 43.8 million Americans of all ages lacked health insurance in 2008. But in 2016, that number was down to 28.6 million, a drop of 15.2 million people. The number of uninsured actually rose during the first 2 years of Obama's tenure due to the Great Recession and then drifted down as the economy recovered. The uninsured dropped sharply beginning in 2014, the first year that the ACA's main insurance provisions took effect. Obama also failed to deliver on his campaign promise to, quote, lower your premiums by up to $2,500 per family per year. For the typical worker, premiums continued to rise faster than wages or inflation, though more slowly than before. Employer-sponsored health insurance covers nearly 56% of the population, according to census figures. Premiums for those policies rose 43% under Obama for family policies and 37% for policies covering a single person. That's according to annual surveys by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Health Research and Education Trust. But premiums rose twice as fast before Obama took office. Family rates rose 97% and single coverage rates rose 90% during George W. Bush's 8 years in office. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the emergency room, or the ICU, clinicians are confronted with a myriad of unpredictable medical crises that sometimes can be challenging to diagnose. Most of these clinicians are now communicating with colleagues via their smartphones, often sending images of a patient's unique symptoms or chest x-rays to one another for shared diagnosis. ICU physician Dr. Josh Landy was noticing a growing trend of image sharing via smartphones to crowdsource second opinions from friends and colleagues across the country. But he also was concerned about the potential violation of HIPAA regulations. So he developed an app for that. He created Figure One, a sort of Instagram for doctors in which images can be de-identified but shared across a dedicated social media platform that would allow input from clinicians within their network. Doctors are using the app to communicate not only with colleagues within their hospital settings, but around the world where someone might have superior expertise with a certain condition. Dr. Landy says the apps get about 500,000 image views a day, with about 80 million total views so far. He sees the potential for this platform only growing as more young digital natives enter the medical workforce. Figure One, a free downloadable app offering secure HIPAA-compliant image sharing among clinicians around the world to reduce the time it takes to zero in on a diagnosis by tapping the collective expert instantly. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.